Kitchen, South Dakota residents. Everything is fine. Everything is beautiful. Go back to your homes. Go back to your jobs. Trust in the authority.
Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep. Work, eat, stay asleep.
Keeping you docile and distracted during times of uncertainty. This is the South Dakota Department of Propaganda Podcast.
Former OpenAI governance researcher Daniel Kokotoslow has made some alarming predictions about the future of AI. He believes that there's a 70% chance that artificial general intelligence, or AGI, could cause catastrophic harm to humanity.
That's quite a claim. Kokotoslow says OpenAI is so eager to develop AGI, they're recklessly racing towards it without considering the potential risks. He joined OpenAI in 2022 and quickly became convinced that the industry could achieve AGI by 2027, but also that it could pose a great threat to humanity.
He's not alone. Kokotoslow, along with former and current employees from Google DeepMind and Anthropic, even penned an open letter voicing their concerns about AI safety. They believe in their right to warn the public about these potential dangers.
Kokotoslow even urged OpenAI CEO Sam Altman to focus more on safety measures and less on making the AI smarter. Despite agreeing initially, Altman didn't seem to take much action, leading Kokotoslow to lose confidence in OpenAI's responsible behavior and eventually quit in April.
He expressed his concerns in an email to his team, saying that the world isn't ready and we aren't ready. Despite these alarming predictions, OpenAI maintains its commitment to providing safe AI systems and engaging in rigorous debate about AI risks.
They even have avenues for employees to express their concerns anonymously and have a safety committee led by board members and safety leaders from the company. Definitely a lot to think about when it comes to the future of AI.
The rise of non-compete agreements and the potential ban on them by the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC. These agreements, often signed by employees, prevent them from working in a similar industry for a set period after leaving their job.
The article shares the story of Matt Paulson, an entrepreneur who faced a lawsuit from his previous employer due to a non-compete agreement he signed. Paulson now runs MarketBeat and doesn't require his employees to sign such agreements, seeing them as unfair to employees and damaging to a company's reputation.
The Federal Trade Commission, in a 3-2 vote, approved a final rule banning non-competes nationwide in many cases. 1 in 5 Americans work with a non-compete, according to the agency.
Although this rule does allow existing non-competes for senior executives to remain, it does, however, prohibit employers from entering into or enforcing new non-competes with these executives. The rule's been legally challenged by business groups, including the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, who argue that the FTC lacks authority over non-competes, as they're subject to state law.
Despite this, the usage of non-competes has increased, especially among lower-level employees. Many see their value in protecting businesses, customer lists, and trade secrets. There's also mention of Alternative H, or that uses non-competes to discourage employees from starting competing businesses.
The rule change would still allow companies to enforce confidentiality or non-disclosure agreements to protect certain competitive elements of business. Furthermore, the FTC rule doesn't apply to nonprofits, meaning that, for instance, non-competes that exist for healthcare executives could remain in place.
Wrapping up, if the FTC ban is upheld, employers will be required to notify current and former employees, still within the time constraint of a non-compete, that their agreement is no longer enforceable. The crux of the matter is that election workers and officials are feeling unsafe due to a marked increase in threats and harassment. The Biden administration, in response, has spotlighted its indictments and convictions in cases involving such threats.
But many election professionals are saying that despite this, federal law enforcement isn't doing enough to deter these bad actors and ensure safety, especially with the fall elections on the horizon.
Amy Cohen, executive director of the National Association of State Election Directors, highlighted this concern, saying that there's a lack of confidence among election officials in seeing a deterrent effect from these federal actions.
It's worth noting, though, the Justice Department launched the Election Threats Task Force in 2021 to deal with this issue. This task force collaborates with local law enforcement and U.S. attorneys' offices to investigate threats.
Since its start, the task force has charged 17 cases, with 8 resulting in prison sentences. Even Attorney General Merrick Garland emphasized that the Justice Department will hold accountable anyone who threatens to harm or kill an election worker.
Despite these efforts, over 2,000 reports of threats or harassment have been submitted by the election community to the FBI since the task force was launched. Only around 100 of those were investigated.
Part of the reason why there aren't more investigations and prosecutions is due to free speech concerns. Anything short of a direct threat to cause physical harm could be protected under the First Amendment.
It's a delicate balance. But as we approach the 2024 elections, it's clear that more needs to be done to ensure the safety of election workers.
The Brennan Center survey revealed that more than half of local election officials are worried about their colleagues' safety, a statistic that hasn't changed since 2022.
We're also getting accounts from various election workers detailing how threats and harassment have affected them. There's a call for federal authorities to take these matters more seriously and provide more follow-up.
However, it's important to remember that law enforcement often can't share details about their work so as not to compromise their investigations.
But as we head into another significant election, there's a collective call for more proactive measures rather than reactive ones from federal law enforcement. This year's Grand Marshal for the event is none other than Chet Jones, a respected figure in the community. His journey from California to South Dakota, where he faced and overcame racial tension while attending Northern State University, is indeed remarkable.
Not just that, Theo. After university, Jones stayed in South Dakota, worked at Northwestern Bell Telephone Company, refereed for high school and college sports, and even served as a District 10 senator. Julian Boudian, the Juneteenth Sioux Falls president, referred to Jones as a giant whose work has paved the way for others.
Jones has urged people to use Juneteenth as an opportunity to educate themselves and contribute towards societal change. The celebration in Sioux Falls starts with the Freedom Walk at 10 o'clock in the morning, followed by a festival that lasts until 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It seems a pro-Nazi group led by C.A. Pulhas protested at the South Dakota Capitol and downtown Deadwood on Saturday. The governor, Kristi Noem, said they were asked to leave the Capitol grounds by the South Dakota Highway Patrol.
However, Pulhas disputed this on social media, saying they stayed as long as they intended and left at their own pace. Now, this group did not file a facility use request for this protest, which is typically required by law.
The reasons behind the protest became clearer when Pulhas mentioned HB 1076 on social media. This new law, which takes effect on the 1st of July, provides additional protection for Jewish people and establishes a formal definition of anti-Semitism.
The group's appearance was quite a sight. They showed up in red shirts and black pants, wearing black head coverings that obscured their faces and holding a large red flag with the black swastika symbol.
The legislation sponsor, Republican Representative Fred Deutsch, expressed his disgust at the group's protesting presence and highlighted why House Bill 1076 was necessary.
Pulhas leads an organization known as Blood Tribe, which is growing across the U.S. and Canada, and is described by the Anti-Defamation League as a neo-Nazi group.
Abortion rights activists in South Dakota are turning a controversial event involving Governor Kristi Noem into a campaign. In her book, Noem shared an incident where she had to kill her dog, which has stirred up some serious backlash.
These activists aren't letting the chance slide. They started selling bumper stickers asking, "Where's Cricket?" in reference to the dog. The proceeds are being channeled to Dakotans for Health, a committee supporting an abortion rights ballot measure.
That measure seeks to introduce abortion rights into the state constitution. This comes in the wake of South Dakota's abortion ban, which kicked in after Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022.
The stickers are proving popular, with nearly 450 sales so far, and Dakotans for Health seem to be doing well, reporting donations of about $39,000 from January through May this year.
The Sioux Falls branch of the NOP also isn't surprised by this occurrence.
With prior instances like swastikas burned into park cement or the KKK passing out flyers, community members have had their fair share of dealing with hate. Langston Newton, Sioux Falls branch president of the NAACP, expressed his dismay.
They all suggest this event should inspire communities to address hate and its harmful effects. Drake highlights the importance of helping neighbors feel like they belong.
The South Dakota Voices for Peace provides training on safely intervening during discrimination incidents with its Bystander to Upstander program. As Julian Bodian from the NOP said, "If hate really has no home in South Dakota, then let's remove the hate."
The 2024 Sioux Falls Pride Parade and Festival saw a record turnout of around 15,000 people, announced by Rachel Polin, president of the Sioux Falls Pride.
For the first time, the event was held at the Sioux Falls Canary Stadium, offering more parking space and vendor space, with 90 vendors in attendance compared to last year's 75.
Adam Jorgensen, a regular attendee, appreciated the new location and its arrangement. He highlighted the sense of community, positivity, and growth as consistent elements throughout the festival's various locations over the years.
Polin mentioned the organization is open to feedback for next year's festival. The Canary Stadium might be the venue again, but it all depends on feedback, budgets, and schedules.
You can do it, baby. I love you so much. Magic. And it's bad news. Bad things are happening. Mom, I'm sorry. Mom, I didn't do a ball.
Over the weekend, neo-Nazi groups marched in South Dakota in Pierre and Deadwood, leading to widespread condemnation. However, leaders from the Sioux Falls branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, NAACP, expressed disappointment with the level of response.
Langston Newton, president of the Sioux Falls and NAACP, expressed shock and disbelief at the news. Ashley Knopf, treasurer of the Sioux Falls and NAACP, echoed these sentiments and added that while racism and discrimination are everyday realities for many people, seeing such an explicit show of hatred was particularly jarring.
Julian Bodian, a Sioux Falls resident of nearly 20 years, said that while racism has always been present in South Dakota and America as a whole, more needs to be done to combat it. This sentiment was aimed particularly at Governor Kristi Noem, whose response to the marches was seen as insufficient by these leaders. They're asking for more than just condemnation. They want action.
Concerns were raised about law enforcement's readiness to deal with such incidents, with both Bodoin and Knopf suggesting that officers weren't adequately prepared to confront the hate groups. Knopf further pointed out that law enforcement's response would likely have been different if the protesters were black men in masks.
The situation has sparked fear within the community. People are questioning how to protect themselves and their communities from such instances of hatred. Knopf mentioned that she had received several calls from people in the black community seeking guidance on how to respond. Additionally, she expressed concerns over potential hate crimes during the upcoming Juneteenth celebrations in Sioux Falls.
In closing, these leaders urged white South Dakotans who stand against hate to show their support for minorities in the state. They encouraged attending Juneteenth festivities and engaging in meaningful conversations with their minority neighbors and coworkers. After all, understanding and humanizing each other might lead to less hate.
is a really important issue. If you put yourself above the Constitution, as he has done.
But what happened?
I think that makes you unfit for office.
Was it the whole January 6th thing?
That's a part of it. I think it's a contribution of factors. But I think it really is just character at the end of the day. And the fact that if you're willing to put yourself above the Constitution, an oath you swear when you take office, in federal office, whether it's president or a member of Congress, you swear an oath to the Constitution. And if you're willing to suborn it to yourself, I think that makes you unfit for office.
Does it?
After the Manhattan jury found Donald Trump guilty of all 34 felony counts concerning his hush money payment to Stormy Daniels, Senator John Thune was quick to label it a politically motivated case, pointing out that the verdict does nothing to absolve the partisan nature of this prosecution.
Thune seems to have his sights set on becoming the Senate majority leader, replacing Chuck Schumer. With Mitch McConnell stepping down, Thune's chances are looking pretty good, despite competition from John Cornyn of Texas and Rick Scott of Florida.
Thune seems to be in an awkward position, though. He endorsed Senator Tim Scott for the Republican presidential nomination months ago. But after Scott's candidacy fizzled out, it appears Thune is not too thrilled about Trump being the GOP standard bearer this year.
While Thune's disdain for the New York jury verdict might resonate within Republican circles, a Morning Consult poll shows that 54% of registered voters nationally approve of the verdict, while only 34% disapprove.
In the upcoming fall elections, Republicans appear to have a good chance of regaining a majority in the U.S. Senate. Democrats will be defending 23 Senate seats, while Republicans will only be defending 11.
So we might see Thune replace Schumer as majority leader after all. However, it remains to be seen how he will stand up against Trump's potential assaults on democracy and the rule of law if Trump manages to win back the presidency.
Anybody going on me, we need every voter. I don't care about you. I just want your vote. I don't care.
I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
The main focus today is on the potential for marijuana legalization across three more states this November. Activists in Nebraska, Florida, and South Dakota are set to put the matter to voters if they can get it on the ballot.
Indeed. One of those activists is Krista Eggers from Nebraska, who is racing against time to gather at least 87,000 signatures on two petitions for a ballot initiative to legalize marijuana for medicinal purposes by July 3. This issue is deeply personal for her, as her son suffers from epilepsy and could benefit from such treatment.
Now, if the group is successful, Nebraska will join Florida and South Dakota in asking voters this fall whether to legalize some marijuana use. Interestingly, in Florida and South Dakota, medical marijuana is already allowed. So the question this time will be about legalizing adult recreational use.
Speaking of South Dakota, this fall will actually mark the third straight election with a recreational marijuana measure on the ballot. The state's voters approved legalization of both medical and recreational use in 2020, but the constitutional amendment was later overturned.
Overall, 38 states and the District of Columbia allow the medical use of cannabis products. On top of that, 24 states plus the District of Columbia allow adults to use it recreationally. However, it's important to note that marijuana still remains illegal under federal law.
While a lot of states have legalized marijuana through legislation, there are still some where lawmakers are hesitant to address this issue, especially in more conservative parts of the country. That's why activists often resort to ballot initiatives.
Attitudes towards marijuana are changing slowly but surely. Even some conservative states like Alabama and Kentucky have legalized it through legislative action.
Lastly, we should also touch on the situation in Florida. There, a ballot initiative which requires a supermajority of 60% to pass is being backed by John Morgan, a lawyer and Democratic fundraiser who supported the successful effort to legalize medical marijuana in 2016.
It just goes to show how complex this issue can be, with different laws and attitudes across the country.
Thank you all for joining us for today's discussion.
The days of local meth labs are gone. Nearly all meth, fentanyl, heroin, and cocaine come from across the southern U.S. border, with the Sinaloa and Jalisco cartels in Mexico topping the list.
It's not just limited to the reservations, as some may believe. These cartels are targeting communities across the state. The article quotes Brendan Johnson, a former U.S. attorney for South Dakota, who says it's a misconception to think that there's a direct link between Mexico and reservations.
Indeed. Tribal leaders have rejected accusations that reservations are key sources or destinations for drugs. They regard these claims as racist, divisive, and unsubstantiated. Tribal nations have even banned Governor Kristi Noem from their lands because of such remarks.
The article also mentions Stephen Bell, a special agent in charge for a U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration region that includes North and South Dakota. Bell acknowledges that while ties to cartels are fewer in the upper Midwest due to lower population, there is still significant investigative activity linked back to cartel presence.
The article also talks about a few risk factors in rural areas, including tribal regions. Drugs can fetch higher prices in smaller communities due to being farther from their source, and less law enforcement presence can facilitate trafficking.
It's clear that drug trade is an issue not limited to urban areas or specific communities. Anyone possessing large quantities of drugs like meth is likely connected to cartel sources that produce these substances for shipment to the U.S., whether they're aware of it or not.
These law enforcement agencies aren't merely focusing on end users. They're working together with local and tribal law enforcement to identify and dismantle these trafficking networks.
The article also discusses how traffickers send drugs through the U.S. mail because FedEx and UPS have more sophisticated screening processes. It's suggested that greater scrutiny on the Postal Service could help intercept a lot of drugs.
Finally, we hear from a drug dealer who was recently sentenced to federal prison. She shares her experiences and perspectives on drug trafficking, shedding light on how addiction drives both buyers and sellers.
She also talks about how cartels find footholds in communities by using addicts' homes as hubs for sales until they draw police attention. Even though rural areas aren't the prime spots for trafficking, they still face significant dangers from the drug trade.
The headline here is that a majority of South Dakotans are in favor of a change in the way primary elections are conducted, according to a poll co-sponsored by South Dakota News Watch and the Cheeseman Center for Democracy at the University of South Dakota.
The proposal is for Amendment 8, which would establish a top two primary system for governor, Congress, and state legislative and county races. This means instead of political parties holding separate primary contests, all registered voters would be able to vote on which two candidates make it to the general election.
South Dakota Open Primaries Chairman Joe Kirby argues that this approach is more fair as it allows all voters to have an equal say in electing their representatives.
But not everyone's on board. The amendment is supported by 82% of Democrats and 59% of independent voters. However, only 40% of Republicans are in favor, with 43% against and 18% undecided.
There's some concern that this shift could actually hurt the Democratic Party. There's an argument that open primaries might incentivize Democrats and Democrat-leaning independents to vote for a moderate Republican, thus potentially strengthening one-party control.
Now that Amendment H is certified for the ballot, we can expect more debate around this issue. State Representative Aaron Aylward is among those opposing the proposal, suggesting it would essentially create two general elections in South Dakota.
Apart from this heated debate over primaries, the poll also shed light on broader issues concerning democracy. More than 60% of South Dakotans expressed dissatisfaction with how democracy is working in the United States. This feeling of dissatisfaction was particularly strong among Republicans.
This dissatisfaction extends to perceptions about election results, too. 74% accepted the outcome of the 2020 presidential elections, with clear distinctions based on party affiliations. While a large majority of Democrats and independents accepted President Biden's win over Trump, less than 60% of Republicans did.
Lastly, it's worth noting that only three states currently use a top two primary system, which South Dakota is considering: California, Washington, and Nebraska. With low voter turnout in recent elections, there's hope that this change might increase civic engagement in South Dakota.
Definitely a topic we'll be keeping our eyes on as we approach the November elections.
The highest honor that only 6% of Girl Scouts in the nation can earn for her project supporting LGBTQ2S+ inclusivity.
Gabriela's project, called Supporting the Rainbow Project, Creating Brave Spaces, aims to create safe spaces in Sioux Falls for LGBTQ2S+ teens and young adults. These spaces provide a community that involves activities, support groups, and wellness workshops.
Gabriella was inspired to undertake this project due to her older sister's experiences. After moving from Miami to Sioux Falls with their mother, Angelica Morales, Gabriella's sister came out as queer. This experience led Gabriella to realize the need for such inclusive spaces.
She didn't hesitate to reach out to her community, connecting with people and organizations to make her vision come to life. She even held her first event, Superhero Trivia, at a local church, which attracted attendees who participated in superhero-themed activities.
Gabriella's accomplishment is even more impressive considering she was an independent Girl Scout, known as a Juliet, without a troop in Sioux Falls. Despite this, she persevered with the help of her mother, who acted as her troop leader.
What's next for Gabriella? She's not stopping just because she won the award. She plans to continue the Rainbow Project Sioux Falls as a nonprofit organization alongside her mom and sister.
That's commitment right there. It's about making the world a better place, which is what the Gold Award recognizes.
It's certainly an inspiration. Well done, Gabriella. We're proud of you. The governor has been pushing for the state's 9 tribes to sign agreements letting state officers enforce tribal law. But this is met with resistance, especially from tribal leaders like Crow Creek Tribal Chairman Peter Linkeek, who believes outside officers aren't the answer to day-to-day issues facing his reservation.
As the article points out, Crow Creek does not have its own police force and relies on Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs for policing. Following a murder last year at a known drug house, the tribe launched its own security task force to combat the public safety issues. The force is funded by proceeds from the tribe's cannabis operation and its farmland.
They're taking matters into their own hands given the lack of sufficient federal support. There's a possibility that this security force could eventually evolve into a full tribal police department, but that's all speculation at this point.
On the other side, opinions are divided among residents about Governor Noem's calls for comprehensive audits of federal funding for tribes and her stance on banning her from tribal lands. Some agree with her calls, but disagree with her rhetoric or the ban, while others believe she should visit and learn firsthand.
Many residents don't necessarily agree with state law enforcement on tribal lands, but acknowledge the drug problems are real. They believe state officers should help catch drug couriers on state highways leading onto reservations, rather than directly enforcing laws on tribal land.
The concern is that these issues aren't isolated to reservations. They're statewide problems that require collaboration at all levels. Some residents feel that the governor's approach has been divisive rather than helpful.
It's clear that there's a need for better public safety within these communities, but how to achieve that remains a point of contention between state and tribal authorities. This article provides an insightful look into this ongoing issue within South Dakota's reservations.
That's it for today.